The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. I'm Dina Blumenthal, a human-animal studies master's student, only a few thesis edits away from receiving my degree. Therefore, it is indeed an honor for me to introduce our guest this evening. Franz de Waal, renowned biologist, primatologist, and ethologist, began his career in his native Holland before moving to the United States in 1981. In 1982, he published his first book, Chimpanzee Politics, comparing the social behaviors of chimpanzees involved in power struggles to behaviors of human politicians. Finally, a biologist confirmed and explained the similarities that we'd all suspected long before. Professor de Waal has continued to explore parallels between primate and human behavior, boldly attributing emotion, intention, morality, reconciliation, empathy, and so many other cognitive abilities to non-human animals that had previously been dismissed or ignored in that population. Author of the recent The Bonobo and the Atheist, his work has been published in hundreds of academic articles, including many highly regarded journals, which include Science, Nature, and Scientific American. He has been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences, and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. And in 2007, he was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. In 2011, Discover selected him as one of the 47 great minds of science, all time, that is. Currently, he holds the title of C.H. Candler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University and is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Center in Atlanta. Professor de Waal's newest book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?, challenges the idea that human intelligence should be the ruler against which all other non-human animal intelligence is measured, as it has been for so long. He reveals to us the immensely impressive capabilities of many species, from elephants to whales to wasps, and the importance of attempting to understand intelligence from within each species' own unique contexts. As one New York Times review put it, frankly, it deals a pretty fierce wallop to our sense of specialness. I have had the unique privilege of hearing him speak before and of studying under a former doctoral student of his. And while you, ladies and gentlemen, most of you, may not be able to do the latter, I am honored to be with you tonight and to join you in welcoming Professor Franz de Waal to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Yeah, chimpanzee politics. We are in the season of chimpanzee politics, I think. I have this impression, you know, when I see people comparing the size of their hands, that we have descended below the level of chimpanzee politics. So I will be talking today about smartness, smart animals. And this question, I know many people think the answer is no, but I think the answer is yes. I'm an optimist. But you wouldn't have thought so the last 100 years if you have looked at what people have done in science with animals, because animals were, intelligence was sort of downplayed as what animals do is based on instinct and on simple learning, and there was not room for much more. Nowadays, I think in the last 25 years, we've had many young scientists who are working on the assumption that animals are actually very intelligent and that animals do have a cognition that is adapted to our environment. And I'll try to explain what that field has given us in the last few years. And I'll not just talk about the primates. The book that I wrote treats a lot of other species, even though I think it often starts with the primate studies. I'm going to give you a few examples just to get you in the mood. This is Lisala, a female bonobo, who has picked up a very heavy rock. And she also has a baby on her back. And she's going to be walking for half a kilometer with that rock. Now, my postdoc, Zana Clay, immediately started filming because, as an expert of apes, she knows that Lizana is going to do something with the rock. It's a bit like when you see a guy walking in the street with a ladder, you know he's going to use the ladder, otherwise he's stupid. So, and the same with an ape. Ape will not do something like this without a reason. So that's why Zana started following her. Now, you're not going to see the whole clip. This is half a kilometer, so this takes a long time. It's in a forest near Kinshasa where we do our studies of bonobos. So it's a sanctuary. These are not really wild bonobos. And this takes a long time, but the clip is only a minute. Now she drops the rock, and she picks up a few items. And now she continues on her way. And she now goes to the only place in the whole forest there where there's a hard surface. And now she has her baby on her belly. And what she's going to do there, what she has picked up in the meantime, are nuts, hard nuts, and she's going to crack them with the rock. So if you think about this, what that means is that she picked up her tool about 15 minutes before she was going to use the tool and before she even had the nuts in her hand. She probably knew where these nuts could be found. And so we're very interested at the moment in what is called time travel, thinking back to specific events, thinking forward, planning your actions, like this is a planning sequence. People do experiments on that. And so the whole idea that animals are trapped in the present, which people often assume, is really not true. It's not even true for rats. There's rat studies on this issue also. The second thing I want to show you is, this is Rowena, a chimpanzee at Yerkes that I work with, and she's using our cell phone as a mirror. She has a hole in her head, which is caused by a male. So she has an injury, and she's using the mirror to inspect the injury. So this is very special. Your average dog is not doing this. And if you have a dog who does this, you call me. And I'll probably explain to you that the dog is not doing it. So this is mirror self-recognition. And to do mirror self-recognition, you need to understand that what you see in the mirror is yourself. So you need to make that connection. This is what a capuchin monkey does. Capuchin monkey is very interested in the mirror image, but is not using it to inspect itself. So a monkey is, of course, something different than an ape. You're basically apes. Then you have gorillas and orangutans and bonobos and chimpanzees. Those are the apes. They're the primates without tails. Monkeys have tails, as you see. And my chimpanzees, when, for example, in Georgia, I have sunglasses on, they immediately start looking in my sunglasses as a mirror, and they use the reflection to look inside of their mouths. The inside of their mouths is a part of their body they never get to see. They always feel it, but they never get to see it without a mirror. So they want to see that. And the females will turn around to look at their behind. The males never turn around. They don't care about their behind. But they do care about the females behind. Now here we have a Yumu, a young male chimpanzee in Kyoto, who has learned to tap numbers on a computer screen in the right order, from 1 to 9. And that's, of course, already remarkable enough. And the numbers always appear in a different configuration. But then the numbers disappear from view. You will see how that goes. So they're visible only for 200 milliseconds, which is a blink of an eye. And he needs to remember where they are. And he's going to make an error. You will see how that goes. Error. He can do this with 9 numbers. I went to Kyoto. I looked at the computer screen. If I stare at 5 numbers for 2 minutes, I can do it. I'm very proud of that. But he does it with 9 and with a much shorter interval. And then they invited the British memory champion to Japan. And he came with a BBC crew, and they filmed everything. And it was never broadcast because he lost. He did not want it to be broadcast. Then some American scientists who were very upset by this, because a human was better than humans in this, and apparently that's not a good thing. And so they went into training, and they trained themselves till they can do it with five numbers. But you know, the five number thing, I think we can do that too. But they never did it with nine numbers, and a human is now up to 15 numbers. So the question now is, why are people so upset? Why did people get upset by this? Why do we need to be better at everything that you can imagine? You know, there are birds who can remember 10,000 locations of seeds that they hide in the fall and that they find back in the spring. We cannot do that. Do we need to be better at everything? But that's a sort of the assumption. That's the assumption of the Scala Naturae, is that we are at the top and everything is below us. And people want to assume that for cognition as well. So how do we test animal cognition? This is a cartoon which says, for a fair selection, everybody has to take the same exam. Please climb that tree. And that's why the chimp is smiling, I think. So you cannot really compare animals that easily. People have been doing that all the time, but even a dog and a cat, even though they're both mammalian predators, they have very different reactions to things. And so why would you test them in exactly the same way? That's almost an impossibility. So you need to have species-appropriate testing. You need to avoid the clever Hans effect, and I'll explain what that is. And you need to be very careful with negative evidence. People have sort of exaggerated the importance of negative evidence. It's something that they did not find. So Clever Hans was a horse in Germany a century ago who could do arithmetic. So you would ask him how much is 3 times 12, and he would 3 times 4, and he would tap his hoof 12 times. Or you could give him square roots. You could say, today is the 28th, what is it next week, Wednesday? He could do all these things. He was marvelous, and people really admired the horse. He had a huge following, until a psychologist found that he could only give the answer if his owner also knew the answer. So they tested him with a curtain between him and the owner, and all of a sudden he couldn't do it anymore. And what that meant is that he was very sensitive to human body language. The owner would be standing there, and the horse would be tapping his hoof 12 times, and if he reached number 12, the owner would shift his position or look up at him or indicate, basically, unconsciously, that he had reached the magic number. And so Hans was not stupid. Hans was actually very good at reading human body language, but he did not do the calculations that people believed he was doing. So that's the clever Hans effect, and we always need to avoid that. So here you have a dog who knows 1,000 words, and he's being tested by his owner.
Fine paws. Good dog. Okay, bring it on. Yeah, there's paws. Case. Fine goose. Go find goose. Find goose. Yeah, that's goose. Bring me goose. Goose. Enter. Peppermint. Find peppermint. Find peppermint.
Now, the trick here is that there is a partition between the owner and the dog. So if the owner would be sitting there without that partition and would be looking at these items, and we would immediately say, well, there's a potential of a clever Hans effect, is that the dog is maybe paying attention to where the owner looks. And we try to block that, and that's how we prevent the clever Hans effect. And we do that all the time now in animal research. That's a sort of requirement, is that we exclude the role of human body language. But in child research, look at this.
Between the capacity to use tools, speak, and cooperate,
this is the way children are tested.
Truly unique.
I would say we are much better at testing animals than at testing children at the moment, because there's enormous potential for clever Hans effects here. And with children, there's all these problems that we have. These are typical comparison. This is how we present the problem to a child. This is how we present the problem to the ape. The child is sitting on the lap of the parent. That's one of the things. One is also the language issue. We talk to these children all the time, and they get things explained. We can talk to the apes, but they don't know what we're talking about. They sit in an open space. The apes sit behind the barrier. There's parental support, which is the Clever Hans effect, basically, because no parent is neutral about their child. Their child is always a genius, and so the parent is always ready to help that child one way or another. And so that's a big help. And then the biggest difference is really the child is tested by its own species, and the chimpanzee is tested by a different species. And so when we make these comparisons, usually the children come out better and smarter than the apes, but I really don't know what it means. This is negative evidence that we get on the apes that could be explained by the disadvantage that they have in the testing. And this has happened over and over. And people are so eager to see differences between humans and apes that they always jump on these differences and say, oh, we can do this, but the apes cannot do that. But we test them in this particular way. Now, one of these results was that apes don't ape. So we had presented children with a puzzle box, and the human would show how you open it, and the child would imitate it, and they did the same thing with apes, and the apes were not doing it. And instead of concluding that maybe the apes are not particularly into us and don't pay attention to us, no, they concluded the apes lack the capacity for imitation, even though we have the verb aping, I think, for a reason. So we decided to set up a test that is more species appropriate, in the sense that in chimpanzees, of course, typically, young chimps, they learn techniques like the nutcracking, very similar to what you saw Lizala do. The young chimps learn that by watching their elders. They lean on them, there's no barrier, that's their mother, they're very attached to her, and they learn a lot of things from her. And so that's what we wanted to set up in our testing. So I'm going to show you our imitation study that we did. This is actually my group of chimps. This is my office up here. And they live outdoors in Georgia. We have two of these groups. And we test them by calling them into a building. So we call them by name. They come voluntarily to be tested. They not only do they know their names, they know each other's names, so we can ask one chimpanzee to get another one for you. And then we put them in the building for, let's say, half an hour or an hour, and we do experiments with them. And in this particular test, we have an apparatus from which you can get food in two different ways. You can either lift something up and the food will roll out, or you can use the stick, the same stick, to push it in there hard enough so that the food will roll out. So from the same apparatus, you can get food in two different ways. And then we train high-ranking females in each group to do the technique. Now, we use high-ranking females because they're going to be the model for the rest of the group. If you take a low-ranking female, since there's food involved in the thing, she may be kicked off the apparatus and by others, and so then she cannot be a model. So you need to have a high-ranking individual. We don't use males, because the males have no time for our experiments. The males are into politics and sex. And if you bring them into the building without their buddies are in the group, who knows what they're doing? They're doing all sorts of things that they're not supposed to do. And they get very nervous about that. So the males are not really good for this particular task. Now here you have the two groups, and we have one poker and one lifter. And then in this group, basically everyone became a poker, and in this group here, almost everyone became a lifter. And so we were the first to demonstrate that chimpanzees are perfectly good at imitation, and we have done many other experiments that support that view. So they're very good imitators, but of other chimpanzees. So the negative evidence that people had for what they do with humans is really probably related to the fact that they don't relate so closely with humans. This is a video of the experiment.
All you get is a stick.
Lovely.
And I'm going to put in it a food reward. And it's your job to try and get that out.
Right. Ah, how about this? This looks like...
I soon discovered one way to get the reward. Poke at it. I was a genius.
I did it.
But the machine has a second solution. It took me a while, but eventually I realised you lift the lever.
There you go.
I was a genius again. So there you have it. Two ways to get the M&M. Lifting and poking. The next step was to teach one chimp to poke and one to lift. Then, put these new expert chimps into different groups and see if the other chimps learn from them. Creating two separate cultural traditions. The lifters and the pokers. And because they're so eager to learn, it works.
Yeah, so as I said, there's now a lot of evidence. There's actually studies now on dog imitation and monkey imitation. And so the whole issue is over. And this has happened so many times, is that people claim we are the only ones to do this or that. It's the theory of mind or making tools. I'll get to the tool making and so on. So they have these claims. Then when we demonstrate that actually some animals can do the tasks, then we forget about it. And then they move on to the next claim. In the last 50 years, we have probably seen at least 20 claims of human uniqueness that have been dropped. And that now people don't even talk about. They don't even remember that they existed. So negative evidence is always problematic, and that's why I want to show something about elephant self-recognition, so the same self-recognition I showed for the chimp. Elephants had been tested with mirrors, and people had concluded that they don't recognize themselves in the mirror. And this was based on a mirror test with a mirror of about this size. And so what does the elephant see? A lot of gray moving around, probably. So, and they concluded the elephant doesn't have self-awareness, which is like a real big conclusion based on that. So we decided to test elephants on a much bigger mirror. This is Josh Plotnick, who does these tests in Thailand. This is me sitting on Pepsi the elephant. Pepsi is being marked on one side of its head with paint that is visible. On the other hand, on the other side, we have the same paint. We got it from the manufacturer without the color substance in it. And so Pepsi feels himself being marked on both sides, but only one of the two is visible. And then we put them in front of a mirror, and in this case it's a much bigger mirror, and it's an accessible mirror, and here he's standing with a mark on the left side of his head, and the sham mark that you cannot see is sitting on the other side of the head. Now this is a different day where he has been marked on the right-hand side of his head, and the sham mark is now on the other side, and he's tasting it. Now look at what he does at the end here. Just like the apes, he opens his mouth. He wants to see inside of his mouth. So we demonstrated that at least some elephants, because not all elephants do this, but at least some elephants recognize themselves in the mirror. Let me say one more thing on elephants. There was five years ago, there was a publication which said, well, we should, when we compare the intelligence of species, we should just look at the neuron count. How many neurons do they have in the brain? We're not going to look at the size of the brain, the size of the body, who cares? We're just going to count neurons. And since humans have the most neurons, everyone was pleased with this particular conclusion. Then it was found 2 years ago that actually elephants have 3 times more neurons than we do. And all of a sudden, people got very hectic and they didn't know what to do anymore with the neuron count issue. Instead of concluding maybe the elephant is smarter than us. No, that was not an acceptable conclusion. But this whole thing, this whole contest principle, like who's the smartest of them all, and it always needs to be us, of course, is fundamentally wrong. The cognition of a species is very much adjusted to its circumstances, and each species has a different senses and has different environment and different requirements, and so each species has some specializations that relate to orientation, or echolocation is a very big specialization which we don't have at all. So am I smarter than an octopus? Is that even a question that is interesting, given that the octopus has its neural system all distributed over its whole body? And I don't, of course. These questions are silly, I think. The question of are we smarter than an animal is not a good question. The question is, how is the cognition of an animal adapted to its circumstances? So negative results, this is sort of the mantra of experimental science. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And we should always keep that in mind when people say, well, they cannot do this, they cannot do that. You may not have tested them the right way. That's the main thing. Now, another item I want to bring up is what I call cognitive rippling. Is that, in general, everything that we find, usually first in the apes, like chimpanzees, we find it first there and we say, well, actually, animals can also do this or can also do that. Is then very soon, usually within 10 years, it is found in dogs and dolphins and crows and elephants and all sorts of other species. So that's the cognitive rippling that we see in our field. And as an example, I want to talk about tool use. Now, tool use in apes, of course, we all know, and is very well documented. And apes not only use tools, but they also make tools. It's sort of interesting because there was a book in the 1950s, which the title is Man the Tool Maker. And the claim was by an anthropologist that, yes, animals use tools, but we are the only ones who make tools. Then it was, of course, discovered that chimpanzees make tools in the field. And then he claimed that we are the only ones who make tools to make tools. It's probably true, but we can go on for a long time like this. It all started with Köhler. So Wolfgang Köhler, a German psychologist, he was very original in his approach. He would hang a banana from the ceiling and give his chimpanzees a bunch of boxes and a bunch of sticks and see what they would do with it. Now, the chimps would make all sorts of attempts to get the banana, but they were unsuccessful. And then all of a sudden sit around and start staring at the situation, and that might take a long time. And after a while, they would all of a sudden jump up and stack the boxes and reach the banana. They would take the sticks and stick them into each other and make a longer stick like that. And so Köhler called it insight, saying that they had a sudden flash of insight, which was not based on rewards, so it was not trial and error learning, and it was based on thinking the situation over. Now, Köhler said that, but American behaviorists, you know, the Skinnerians, they don't like that kind of language that he was using. So they, even today, you will find behaviorists who cannot pronounce the name of Köhler. They can hiss the name, or they can say, Köhler, who knows? They get all nervous because Köhler was the first one to say that animals may actually think. And this was an unacceptable view. Now, recently, we replicated Köhler's experiment in the zoo where I used to work in the Netherlands. So we hung up a bunch of bananas very high. And you will see what happens. We gave them boxes and sticks. Here's a young male. And he's not stacking boxes in this case. But it is very interesting that he always puts the box in the right position, as high as possible, you see? So he keeps trying. He has the right idea. He has a box and a stick. He's going to reach the banana here. This is the alpha male. The alpha male has a different strategy. So that was... And then we had a high-ranking female, the top female of this colony, Mama was her name, who is featured prominently in chimpanzee politics. She just died 2 weeks ago. And her granddaughter is now the alpha female, and that's what you will see. Her granddaughter found a solution that Köhler has never described and that I've never heard of, that anyone has ever seen. And it's a very effective solution. You will see how that goes. It was one of the best solutions I've seen, but it was an unofficial one, I would say. So now I'm going to show you, because these same chimps became famous because they brought down a drone. They see birds all the time who fly back and forth over their island, but they hated a drone. GoPro had a drone going over the zoo, and they had seen the drone many times. And you will see what happened with the drone. And I need some sound for this, so turn up the sound, please, because this is a GoPro advertisement. That's what it became. So here the drone is flying over the zoo, direction of the chimps. Here it arrives at the chimps, and there's five chimps sitting there with sticks, just sitting ready. Yeah. So meet your chimps overlords. So we thought we would have to pay for the drone, but GoPro turned it into an advertisement. Now, after the chimps came the capuchin monkeys. Now, capuchin is sort of interesting because the scientists who work with chimpanzees, they had woven this very coherent story. They said, we had the Stone Age and chimpanzees have a Stone Age to crack nuts. And that all sort of fits together. And then the capuchin monkeys came and they didn't fit at all because the capuchin monkey is very distantly related to us compared to a chimpanzee. But they have very sophisticated tool use. They bring the nuts to certain locations and they bring the tools to certain locations. And so the capuchin monkeys crack nuts with stones too.
Palm nuts are extremely hard and difficult to crack open. It only works if you get it exactly right. Somehow, these clever monkeys get amazingly good at it.
So now this sophisticated tool used, the Stone Age, so to speak, reached the monkeys. And this has happened all the time. And then, of course, the crows came. And then the crows are very distantly related to the primates. They have large brains relative to their body. So crows and ravens and so on. And we knew for a long time that New Caledonian crows modify branches and twigs to reach grubs and to extract them. So they actually make tools. And then a famous Betty the Crow in a laboratory in Oxford, she showed how she does that. And so that became an experiment. They would have a little bucket in a tube with food in it, and she was given a straight wire, and she couldn't do anything with the straight wire. So here she's trying, but there's no way to get that bucket out this way. So she took the straight wire out, and she started bending it. Bending here in this case, until she has a hook. And now she uses the hook to extract the food. So now we have tool making in the crows. So Betty the toolmaker, basically. And this has happened, this is what I'm saying, this has happened over and over. Then we got the octopus. The octopus uses coconut shells to hide in. I actually find the locomotion almost more fascinating. I'm not sure I can handle this with eight legs, you know. So it's very complex, and the octopus uses these coconut shells to hide because many animals in the ocean eat the octopus, and so there's good reasons for it to hide. So that's tool use right there. And then we got also the crocodile. So this happens at heron colonies where the herons are looking for branches and the crocodiles provide them with the branches, but for a price. You will see how that goes.
Somehow the occasional alligator can be seen floating around balancing a stick perfectly on its nose. Is it just coincidence? Or is this 400-pound reptile with a brain the size of a walnut a master of deception? The egret apparently has eyes only for the stick. and the alligator has snagged the chef's special. This amazing.
So this is not necessarily accidental behavior. So you could assume that maybe the alligators sometimes have sticks on their noses, and this may happen. But it turns out that around a heron colony, there are no sticks anymore because they're all picked up for the nests. And so the crocodiles, the alligators, bring them in. They bring sticks to the location. So it's very intelligent behavior in a way. And it's tool use. And so tool use fits my rule of cognitive rippling, which is basically that every cognitive capacity that we discover in other animals ends up being older and more widespread than we thought. So, for example, in my own work, I started working on empathy in chimpanzees and empathy in elephants and so on. And before you knew it, we're now working on empathy expressions in rodents, so voles and rats and so on. And it's actually widespread in all the mammals and probably also in the birds. And this has happened all the time. All these characteristics that we think are very fancy, they turn up in many different species. Now, the usual objection to the study of cognition in other species is, first of all, that people say we will never know what they think. But, you know, I don't even know what you think. You may tell me what you think. Am I willing to believe it? You know, there's many psychologists who test people by asking them questions and they fill out questionnaires. I don't trust any of it because I think people make up a lot of stories about themselves, especially on sensitive topics. And I don't think with humans we get very far asking them what they think, and I'm not sure that with animals. With animals what we do is we propose a mechanism. We say, well, they must be solving this problem this particular way, and then we test it out to see if that hypothesis is correct. And what they exactly think in the meantime is not necessarily our goal. The other one is that people say anthropomorphism is a sin. So you should not ascribe intentions and solutions and thinking and so on to animals because that's all anthropomorphic and we should avoid that. And I think that's a problematic statement for animals very close to us. So for animals who are distant, it's maybe different. Anthropomorphism is defined as the misattribution of human-like mental experiences to other species. And yes, there are animals where we should be careful. So for example, here we have the kissing gourami. Now, I'm a very big fan of fish. I have a lot of fish at home. And the kissing gourami will be in the tank, and they will be kissing the whole day right in front of you there. But it is not really kissing. These are males who have teeth in their mouths, and they hook them together, and they fight over territories. And we may call it kissing, but it has nothing to do with kissing. It's basically fighting. Now, this is a chimpanzee kiss. This is a reconciliation between a male on the left and a female on the right. They had a fight. They get together. There's a very gentle mouth-to-mouth contact between them. And that's how chimpanzees kiss. They kiss when they greet each other or when they reconcile with each other. This is how bonobos do it. They do tongue kissing. So there's more Hollywood-type kissing here. Funny story. I knew a caretaker who was used to chimps, and he started working in San Diego Zoo with bonobos, and he accepted the kiss, and he had not counted on the amount of tongue that went into the kiss. So this is much closer to how we use kissing, and I feel that if related species use similar behavior under similar circumstances, we have to use the same labels. We do the same with horses and zebras. If horses and zebras, which are about as close as we to each other as we are to chimpanzees, if horses and zebras would have the same behavior under the same circumstances, of course we would give it the same label. And so why wouldn't we do that with animals who are close to us? So there's two ways of looking at this, at the evolution of behavior. One is what is called convergent evolution. Let me explain. The fish and the dolphin, they live in the same environment and they have very similar body shapes, but the dolphin doesn't descend from the fish. The dolphin descends from land animals, but has adopted that same feature of streamlining, and we call that an analogy. These are similar traits that they have gotten through independent evolution because they adjust to the same environment. So that happens very often. So, for example, the tool use of crows and the tool use of primates doesn't come from a common ancestor, so it's an analogy. It's basically a convergent evolution. Then you have the situation where animals are closely related, like let's say the human and the chimp, and they have similar facial expressions, which they use under similar circumstances, and which go back to an ancestral type, like a monkey. Monkeys also have these expressions, and we call that homology. These are similar traits which have a shared ancestry. And this monkey is actually very famous because this monkey took a selfie. So the monkey stole a camera and took a selfie. And there was a court case because the photographer wanted to have money from this picture. But the court decided that the monkey had taken the picture. So, yeah. So this is called a homology. And in our language, we should honor the homologies that exist. So if you have, for example, the human hand and the chimpanzee hand, they are structurally very similar. They have the same number of bones in them. They're functionally very similar. So we call this a hand. We don't call this a paw or a flipper or a fin or whatever. No, this is a hand. And so we use the same terminology because there's a homology and they're clearly related to each other. And the same applies to behavior. This is a baby gorilla who's being tickled by its mom, and this is the expression on its face. And the sound will also be very similar to human laughing. And so we have to call it laughing instead of obscuring it and calling it vocalized panting or something like that. Let me show you how. This is human laughing. This is orangutan laughing. This is bonobo laughing. And the sound is very similar. This is chimpanzees. So if we get these behaviors that are very similar and clearly related to each other and sort of expressions of a group of animals that are related to each other, we have to use the same labels. And so I'm not opposed to these anthropomorphic labels, as they're called, for species that are closely related to it. And for that reason, I invented a new term for what people want us to do, because they want us to use other terminology, and I call that anthropodenial. Is that that's the a priori denial that other animals can have human-like mental experiences or that humans are like animals. And what we have seen in the last century is a lot of anthropodenial, a lot of attempts to drive a wedge between us and other species, and to do that also linguistically. So not just saying that we can do this and animals cannot do that, so sort of saying that there are these cognitive differences, but also as soon as there are similarities, to try to come up with a terminology that hides these similarities. And in order to illustrate that, this is the last experiment I will be talking about here. In order to demonstrate the anthropomorphism and how important it is for the interpretation of behavior, I'm going to show you our experiment on fairness that I did with Sarah Brosnan. And I'm going to show you the original experiment. We've done it now with apes and with crows and with dogs, and it has been done with many different species now. But I'm going to show you the original test that I did with Brosnan on capuchin monkeys. So we discovered that capuchin monkeys are very sensitive to the reward distribution. If you give both monkeys grapes, they're fine with a task. If you give both of them cucumber, they're fine with a task. If you give one of them grapes and the other one cucumber, and grapes are 10 times better than cucumber, they're very unhappy about the situation. At least the one who gets cucumber is very unhappy about the situation. So it's a sort of the Bernie Sanders theme in primatology. And here we go. If both of them get cucumber, and it's a very simple task, and we do it many times, they perform like 100% of the time. If you give the partner grapes for the task, and you're still getting cucumber, you perform only 50% of the time. So economists call that an irrational response, in the sense that cucumber is better than no cucumber, but you're not working for it anymore. And that's because someone else is getting something better. If the partner now gets grapes and doesn't need to work for it, so there's no effort, so gets the grapes for free, you really don't want to do it anymore. So this is actually interesting, the role of effort. This is also true for humans, of course, is that If I have a salary that is twice as high as your salary, and we do the same job and have the same experience, that may seem extremely unfair to you. I may be okay with it, but you probably not. But if I work very hard and I work day and night, and you don't, that's actually quite fair. So we take effort into account also. I'm going to show you this little video that has been now downloaded 25 million times. And it's so popular because in this season, this political season, income inequality is a huge issue. And what you're going to see is a monkey on the right who works for grapes and the one on the left who works for cucumber. Now, he gives us a rock, that's the task, gets a piece of cucumber and eats it. So the first piece is fine. The first piece is totally acceptable. Then this one is going to give us a rock and gets a grape. The one on the left looks at that. The one on the left gives us a rock and gets again cucumber. Gets again cucumber. So when I first published this, there were reactions to it. So people would say, one philosopher wrote us and said, it's impossible that monkeys have a sense of fairness because fairness was invented during the French Revolution. So that's how some people think. They think that our moral principles, they come from a bunch of old guys in Paris who decide this would be a good principle to have, let's apply it in society. But that's really not how human morality works. Human morality is built up from the emotions. And the reason you have such a strong reaction to this, which is very much anthropomorphism that's going on here, is because you recognize this reaction. Our body language is so similar to that of a monkey that you immediately recognize that this monkey is upset. You would be probably doing the same thing. So when you have species that are so close to us and show similar reactions under similar circumstances, we have to assume that the psychology behind it is very similar too. That's for the biologist the simplest assumption. And in order to illustrate that, I want to give you a video clip. There's all these mothers who do my monkey experiments on their children in a way that I would never get approval of at the university. And so here you're going to see a video clip of a mother who tests her two children by giving one a whole cookie and the other one a half cookie. So here we have them.
Cookies. You want cookies? Daniel, here's one cookie.
Ma.
Anna, this one's for you.
Yeah.
Come on. Really?
So this is the irrational response. All the more so because I think the girl is only half the size of the boy, so half a cookie seems fine to me. I recently met a woman who has at home a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, and she says the Chihuahua insists on the same amount of food as the Great Dane. So it can be very problematic. But I think it's a very basic reaction that we have now seen in many species. And so the human sense of fairness has very old roots, and chimpanzees go even further in this. In chimpanzees, the one who gets the grape may refuse the grape till the other one also gets a grape. So it gets even closer to the human sense of fairness. So I want to end with some conclusions. This is a statement by Heisenberg. Heisenberg is a physicist. He says, what we observe is not nature in itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. And that's so important. What we see in animals depends what we ask them. And if we have low expectations, if we think everything in animals must be extremely simple, we're going to find simple things in them. If we have high expectations, we're going to find other things in them. And so that's very important. Then this is Darwin, Charles Darwin. The difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. So he already, and he knew orangutans and chimpanzees and so on at the zoo in London, he already saw that there was continuity in this regard. And this is my conclusion in the book, is that there are many different cognitions. It's not just one cognition. You cannot say, are rats smarter than an octopus? Because the rat and the octopus cannot really be compared. So there's many different cognitions, and I look at human cognition as a variety of animal cognition. And I thank all the people who do this wonderful work with me, and I thank you for your attention. So now we have time for questions, and I believe we all need to use the microphone when people have questions.
Wonderful. Very, very interesting. Are there left and right-handed primates, apes, chimpanzees?
Yeah, there is a lot of research on what is called laterality. Laterality occurs even in frogs and in parrots. And all sorts of animals have a favorite hand or wing or foot or whatever. And in the primates, it is actually, I believe, more left-handed than right-handed. Oh, you're happy with that, okay. You asked it because you're left-handed. Right, right. There's always some agenda behind the question.
There's a lot of talk about consciousness and whether animals have it. Do you have any insights as to what animals may be conscious of their being and those that just react?
Yeah. So consciousness, for me, the issue with consciousness is that I don't know what it is. And it seems like no one knows what it is, because as soon as I ask, like, how would I recognize consciousness in an elephant, no one knows what sort of things I should be looking for. But let me give you a few hints. There are certain things that we cannot do without being conscious of it. So, for example, metacognition, it's called. Knowing whether you know something. Let's say I ask here a question and you can raise your hand if you think you know the answer. That's metacognition. You think that you know the answer. So knowing what you know. And those tests are being done now on primates, but also being done on rats. So you can bring primates in a situation where they have to choose an option. They can get a low quality reward. And then sort of get out of the question. But if they think they know the answer, they can go for high-quality rewards. And monkeys make the right decisions in that regard. We cannot do that without some sort of reflection on our knowledge. The same is true for planning. I showed you the Lisala planning. Planning is very hard to do for the future without some sort of conscious process. And so in the book, I describe several of these mechanisms that people are now investigating. Another one is self-control. Do you know the marshmallow test that we do on children, where a child is giving a marshmallow, and you say, if you wait long enough, you'll get a second one? Now, these things are being done on the apes and recently on one parrot. And again, we cannot do that sort of self-control without consciousness. And the parrot, for example, was great. The parrot could wait 20 minutes for a better reward. And the parrot did the same thing as what the children do. The children try to distract themselves by looking at the sky or singing songs or falling asleep or dancing around or licking the marshmallow and putting it back. The children do all sorts of things to distract themselves. And the parrot was doing the same thing. The parrot also actually fell asleep on occasion. So we think that there are cognitive processes going on in other species that in humans at least require consciousness. And for me, the assumption is usually that if the animals are doing similar things under similar circumstances, the process behind it must be similar. And so consciousness is probably present.
You're talking about aping and how it's better and more effective if the apes learn from each other rather than from humans. Has anybody looked at domesticated animals? Because just from anecdotal evidence, I've noticed that cats and dogs will learn behaviors from each other. I've seen my sister's cat learn to sit up and beg like a dog. So is it a family? Do they have a sense of family and a group sense? Could that be what's making them learn from each other rather than being
as I said, there's now imitation studies on many different species. It's really not limited, I think, to the apes or to the primates. Darwin already described in his early books that a cat who was, what was it again? A dog who was raised by cats started licking its paw and cleaning his face like a cat. So I think imitation is all over the place, and in birds also. Yeah, I think domestic animals are just as good at it. Maybe not as complex as what the apes do, because the apes, they also seem to understand the process behind it, and so they have more complex imitation. But it is not limited to the primates.
You mentioned that, at least jocularly, that there were two cultures, the pokers and the lifters. And then right after that, you mentioned about Wolfgang Kohler and the antipathy of behaviorists. And I remembered a quote from Bertrand Russell talking about animal experimenters, saying that the choices that they make in different countries of animal subjects has an awful lot to do with the human cultures, that the German ape devolves the answer out of his inner consciousness. He sits still and thinks, and the American subject, the white rat, rustles about with incredible hustle and pep, and at last, you know, finds the result by chance. Do you find in your work that different experimenters have different cultural biases about the kinds of things you're concerned with?
There's a lot of cultural effects, and actually in my book, The Ape and the Sushi Master, which is on animal culture, I compare how the Japanese scientists, the Japanese scientists came up with the animal culture concept. It was not the Western scientists, because in the West, the anthropologists would say culture is what makes us human, so they basically excluded the animals. And the Japanese had a very different approach to this whole issue, and so that's why the whole culture concept comes out of Japan. So I think each culture has different approaches. It's probably not also accidental that the two main advocates like myself and Jaak Panksepp for emotions in animals and that we should take them seriously are European. The Americans are so indoctrinated by behaviorism, which excluded all these things and said, we don't want to talk about emotions because we cannot open the black box and we will never know and so on. It's not accidental, I think, that it's two Europeans who are the main advocates of that position. So yes, there's a lot of cultural effect on how you frame your questions, basically.
Have you considered the experiment in which, with two cultures, the lifters and the pokers, you take the high-ranking female from one of the cultures, say the pokers, and introduce her to the lifter culture? What would happen? Would there be a spread of the lifter or the spread of the poker?
I'm sorry to say, what would happen is you would get killed, probably. So the problem with chimps is that they're very xenophobic. So you cannot just move animals around. But in the wild, young females, adolescent females, so like teenagers, they can move around. When they have their first sexual swellings, they try to move into a different territory, and they get protection from the male. So we usually call that swelling a passport. It's like a passport to get into the group because the males will protect her because they're very sexually interested in that new female against other females because the other females are not happy to see new female coming into the group. And so the chimps are very xenophobic. The bonobos are very easygoing between groups. So they have sex and all of this. But in chimpanzees, you cannot just move animals around. It's just an impossibility. But what has happened in some of the field studies is that they have females migrate from this group to that group. And for example, in this group, they crack nuts that in this group are not being cracked. So let's say these guys eat only certain kinds of nuts, and then you may have a female who introduces that other types of food are going to be used. So that is a sort of spreading of habits between groups that may happen in the field, but it's very limited.
I believe I noticed dreams in my dog, and I'm just wondering, is there evidence of that in other animals?
We will maybe at some point know what's going on. I wouldn't be surprised. Why would they not dream? We dream, and so why would they not be dreaming? But we do, at the moment, we do brain scanning on dogs. And that's maybe a way to get at this issue of what is going on in their brain when they're sleeping, REM sleep or whatever they have. And so normally we cannot scan animals in the scanner. Like chimpanzees, we cannot do that because they're very dangerous and they're very big and we need to knock them down, and then you cannot do a cognitive task with them. But with dogs, you can train them to sit still. And we have a scientist at Emory who uses our brain scanner for his dogs. So the dogs are trained at home by the owner to put their head in a little stand, and they get rewarded for that. And so if you do that a couple of months, they get very attached to this little stand, and they will even sleep in that little thing. And then you take that stand and bring it to the scanner and put it in there, and the dog runs into the scanner and puts his head in there and is trained to sit still. And then you can do brain scans on an awake animal. So that's going on at the moment, and that may at some point give answers to this kind of questions.
I noticed that you haven't mentioned baboons. Is there a reason that you didn't mention them, or have you not worked with them, or is there a reason that you haven't worked with them?
I think baboons are very interesting. I cannot mention that. There's a lot of species in the world, but baboons are very interesting animals, especially if you're interested in things like coalition formation, which the male baboons do quite a bit, or the kinship networking with the females, of course, doing quite a bit. Baboons are not so great as at the empathy measures. They have such a strict hierarchy, and the same is true for many macaques. They have such a strict hierarchy that the expression of consolation and empathy is not very common in them. But it's a very smart animal, obviously, a baboon. Yeah.
Good evening. I was wondering if you could say more about that mirror experiment. I come from a tradition where the mirror stage is important for children in a way to discover how the others see them or even guide them in becoming who they are. Do you have more to say maybe in anthropomorphy or experiences with baby animals?
Yeah, so the mirror test is a bit controversial because there are scientists who say that if an animal passes the mirror test, it is self-aware, and if it doesn't, it's not self-aware. So that's a very absolute difference, and I don't believe that. There's only a handful of animals that pass the mirror test without training. Those are humans, the great apes, dolphins, elephants, and the magpie. The magpie is a corvid, it's a large-brained bird. So those are the only ones thus far. And for me, it's not really acceptable to say, well, all the other animals have no self-awareness. Because, for example, you have animals like, let's say, dogs. When they play with each other, they bite each other's legs and each other's tails, not their own tail or their own leg. So they make a distinction between their own body and somebody else's body, which is a form of self-awareness. Or you could also say dogs should maybe be tested on the mirror, because it's a very olfactory species, so we need to develop different tests for dogs than the mirror test. So I have trouble with this very sharp distinction, but it is true, I feel, that the animals who spontaneously recognize themselves in the mirror, they're probably special in what they understand about themselves and about others. And this relates a little bit to development, human development. So in human development, at about 18 months to 24 months, the child starts to recognize itself in the mirror, which is also the age at which children say, look at me, mom, and things. They start to attract attention, and they become more self-conscious. And that's also the age at which they better understand how the situation of others is. And so their expressions of empathy become more complex. They have a better understanding of and sort of getting into the shoes of somebody else and taking the perspective of somebody else. And I feel that all these species who recognize themselves, let's say the dolphin and the elephant and the apes, they have those capacities also of sort of taking the perspective of somebody else. So I think it means more than just recognizing yourself in the mirror, but what exactly it means and how it exactly this works, I don't think we know that.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.